title and one we're excited to hear more about. Like to introduce to you Dwight S. Meltzer, one on the far right there. Dwight is currently a senior investigator with the Special Investigations Unit of Select Health in Salt Lake City, Utah. Prior to his employment with Select Health, Dwight was a special agent with the FBI for 29 years. And during his FBI career, Dwight worked a variety of violations in major offices throughout the country, including Washington, D.C., New York, and Los Angeles. He is a graduate of Brigham Young University with a BA in 1975, so I guess we'll let him stay here today since he had that credential thrown in there. Oh, along with the rest of us. Okay, and our other guest presenter today is Mark S. Waite. Mark began his career in the insurance industry after retirement as a police officer. He has been in law enforcement and the insurance industry for the past 12 years. His experience includes that of a police officer, aviation accident investigator, insurance adjuster, we all know about that, claims manager, and investigator. And he's presently the supervisor of the SIU at Select Health, an Intermountain Healthcare company in Salt Lake City, Utah. Mark holds an accredited healthcare fraud investigator designation from the NHCAA, certified professional coder from the American Academy of Professional Coders, and fraud claim law associate, FCLA, and claim law specialist, FLS, from American Educational Institute. He is the past president of the Utah chapter of the International Association of Special Investigation Units and is a member of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners and National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association. I don't think it's going to get any better than that, so I hope you'll enjoy this session and please welcome our guests.
Thanks. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? We're glad to be here. We always see the tail end of the insurance business, the claims end, and it's been astonishing to see the producing end and to meet and to talk with the agents and the producers. This is outstanding. This is great, and we're glad to be here. I'm fine. Can someone shut those back doors? We tend to get overflow from the exhibitors. we're here today is we are part of the Special Investigations Unit, and almost every insurance company has a Special Investigations Unit. About 10 years ago, they really didn't exist, but as a result of the Special Investigations Unit going up in insurance companies, whether it's property casualty, life, health, it's amazing on what is happening in curtailing insurance fraud. Word is getting around. I'm sure you've seen the ads from workers' compensation about the guys just sitting there going, you know, thank you for paying your premium because I'm spending it, you know, that type of thing. And we're having an effect. And we'll go through today and talking about some of the things that we see and things that, especially at the end, Dwight will be talking about things that you can do as agent, brokers, and producers to help mitigate insurance fraud. Now, we're here today to talk about ethics and leadership. And, you know, what is the definition of ethics? Well, it's kind of hard to find a real true definition, but these are parts, I think, of what makes up an ethical person. And that is being loyal and trustworthiness and being fair in all that you do. Refusing to take unfair advantage. In the last session, how many were here in the last session? You know, I think there's some great examples of not taking unfair advantage of your clients. Preventing harm, concern for the well-being of others, and having the moral duty and obligation to our clients and to those people that we serve. Excellence in our conduct and behavior, and again, having that excellence in our professional standards that we have. One of the great quotes that I think we've heard over and over again, but I think it really is great to repeat, is from William Penn, where he said, "Right is right, even when everyone's against it, and wrong is wrong, even if everyone's for it." And in today's society, do we see that? Unfortunately, yes. Also, George Washington said, "I hope I shall always possess the firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man." I think right there, that is what I would, when I go to my grave, I would like to have on my tombstone, that I had the character of an honest man. Now, when we talk about the word ethics, let's think about what the word itself means. Well, it comes from the word from Greek, and it comes from the word ethos, meaning character, and also from Latin, meaning mores, meaning customs. And together, they combine to how individuals choose to interact with one another. So when we talk about ethical behavior, it's that behavior that we have between one and another. Now, when we talk about ethical behavior, unfortunately, there's people that have unethical behavior. And so those people that have that unethical behavior is called fraud. They can be sucked into this disease that is going about throughout the world today. So what is fraud? Anyone, what would you define fraud as? Yeah. Okay, something that you present that's not true, but it is a fact. But I think the key here is it's the intentional. And that's the key in fraud. It's the intentional deception or misrepresentation that an individual will make towards someone else and they will get them some type of benefit. So the key here is you have to have the intent to take that money or take that policy or whatever you do away from someone else for your own gain. So now, what is healthcare abuse? Anyone know what healthcare abuse is? Well, it's basically anything that doesn't meet that statutory definition of fraud. If you take the intent out of that equation, that is healthcare abuse. I call it revenue enhancement programs that doctors and the different providers and different people get involved with to enhance their revenue, but they do it through overutilization. It's a very fine line between the healthcare abuse and the actual fraud. And so today we're going to talk about what is happening to us in the United States today. Now, we spent in 2005 approximately $1.9 trillion in healthcare services. And it is estimated anywhere from 1% to 10% of that figure is fraud. Now, the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association, they estimate that approximately 3% or $58 billion goes to insurance fraud. Now, I don't know about you, but $58 billion is a lot of money that could be going back to the policyholders or back to us. It's also estimated by the National Insurance Crime Bureau, NICB, that about $30 billion a year goes towards insurance fraud. And the Insurance Research Council, they estimate that on top of that, an approximately $5 billion gets added in bogus auto claims. Now, I don't know about you, but I know my 16-year-old just started driving, and my insurance is sky high. And think what could happen if you spread that $5 billion back to us, our policyholders. You know, I think it can make a major change. But, you know, is there a problem? Is there a problem here in Utah County and the Wasatch Front? Well, believe it or not, in Hollywood, back in 1965, they determined that there was a problem. And I want to watch this and see what you think.
Morning, Harry.
How did I get here?
By stretcher and ambulance.
Oh, my head. What did they give
whole gang of sleeping pills.
Where's the can?
Forget it. You can't get out of bed.
Wait, I can't go. Who says?
Hate to break it to you, kid, but you got a spinal injury.
What?
Your left leg is numb and you got no feeling in the first three fingers of your right hand.
Well, you're crazy. I can move my hand and my leg.
Sure you can, if you want to blow $1 million.
What are you talking about?
That's what we're suing for. They'll offer us $100,000. We settle for $250,000.
I gotta go to the camp.
There we are. I'll bring it to you.
What are you trying to pull? I'm perfectly all right.
There's one thing I hate. It's a patient who makes his own diagnosis.
This is ridiculous. There's nothing wrong with me.
That's what you think. Not only can't you move your hand and your leg, but you had this concussion. So now you got a ringing in your ears and double vision.
Double vision.
How many men do you see?
One. One cheap, chiseling, shyster lawyer who, of all people, had to marry my sister.
Nice talk. I'm handing you $250,000 on a silver platter.
Don't want the money. Don't want the silver platter.
What's the matter? You feel sorry for insurance companies? They got so much money, you don't know what to do with it. They've run out of storage space. They have to microfilm it. What's $250,000 to them? They take it out of petty cash. So don't give me with the scruples.
You know, how true. You know, the general public out there, the big, bad insurance companies, they have so much money. What if I took $1 million from them, they wouldn't even notice. They microfilm their money. You know, it's amazing. As I talked to my neighbors and stuff, some of the people said, you know, well, if I have a burglary in my home, what happens if I just kind of say, well, instead of my 19-inch TV, I had a 52-inch big screen? Well, you know, that's insurance fraud. You know, oh, yeah, I guess it is. And so this embellishing really has taken effect, especially here in Utah. Today we're going to talk about different types of healthcare fraud. First one is member or consumer fraud. The second one is healthcare provider fraud. And the third one is agent broker fraud. Right now, believe it or not, we are spending the majority of our time on the second one right here, on healthcare provider fraud. There's a lot of providers that I call it the revenue enhancement program that are trying to increase their revenue, and we end up paying it. So now Dwight's going to talk about, what is your role in mitigating healthcare insurance? And that's what we want to talk about today. And as such, by being educating you as to the types of scams and schemes that are going on out there, you, the agent broker, can help us to detect that. And we'll talk a little bit later about you being on the front line. You are the front line of defense in this whole plan.
Does that portray a problem? We're going to tag team here a little bit. But let's look at some of the different kinds of fraud that members get involved in. When they have a complete lack of ethical behavior, these are some of the things that happen. First of all, we'll talk about prescription fraud. This is a huge problem nationwide. What we refer to as our drug shoppers or our emergency room frequent flyers. This is a way for people to get the drugs they consider legally, but it's a way for them to get drugs. We get information from the Department of Professional Licensing. We get information from emergency room records, also from family informants, letting us know about individuals and their families who are really abusing the system. Let me just share one particular case that we've just been working on, as a matter of fact. This one individual went to the emergency room over a 5-month period and had bills of over $65,000 in services in an attempt to get any kind of injectable painkiller or drug that she could. And she ended up getting about $300 worth of medications, and yet the emergency rooms were billing over $65,000. You talk about an abuse of a system that's already overloaded and having monumental problems, and you add to that those that are abusing the system, And pretty soon, the emergency rooms are going to be so overcrowded, we won't be able to get into them. Let me share a little bit about this next one, an OxyContin ring that was organized and really doing very well from an illegal point of view in Salt Lake. OxyContin, as you probably know, is a very popular drug of choice on the street and elsewhere. This ring consisted, when it was finally brought down, of 234 different people involved in it. These were patients, and there were runners, there were cappers, all kinds of people involved. The basic scheme was a doctor, a medical doctor, would write prescriptions for OxyContin. So people would go out, find people who had insurance coverage to cover their drugs. They would send them to this doctor. He would charge $400 to $500 for an office visit, the sole purpose of which was to provide a prescription for OxyContin. Then these patients who had health insurance would go out, fill those prescriptions of OxyContin, and come back to see the doctor. If they could afford to pay the $400 to $500 office visit, they could keep the OxyContin pills that they got. If they couldn't afford to pay the office visit, they had to pay 75% of those tablets to the doctor and got to keep the other 25% for themselves. This ring got huge, it was super organized, and it got violent. Eventually, this drug ring cut into the heroin sales of some of the local street gangs. And so as a result, the street gangs wanted a cut and got a cut of those OxyContin pills, which they in turn sold and provided enforcers to this drug ring. Now, when it was all said and done, state investigators determined that the next highest doctor in Utah that prescribed OxyContin on a large scale from a pain management clinic prescribed about 8,500 tablets of OxyContin during this period of time. This particular doctor wrote prescriptions for over 74,000 tablets of OxyContin. And as you can see, it was a huge expense and caused a lot of problems, not only to the healthcare industry, but to society. Now, another area is medical and pharmacy personnel. There are pharmacies around the country that will not question a prescription. They will fill it straight up. The only caveat is one tablet for you, one tablet for me. And those kinds of pharmacies exist today. Another problem area is when the insured and the provider are working together for each other's benefit. Now, we heard a little bit about this in the session before, when a doctor would tell somebody with cancer, I won't write anything down in my records, give you a chance to get some life insurance, and then we'll proceed. So you have the provider and the patient collusion. This is a photo of a pair of insoles or arch supports. Podiatrists recommend these quite often. This is a facsimile of a ankle foot orthotic, an AFO as it's called. They take a prescription. They are quite a bit more expensive. The newer ones have Velcro and straps and everything on there. A foot insole or an arch support is not covered by hardly any health insurance companies. They cost $5, $10. An AFO is covered by insurance, and they cost about $225. We recently had a doctor who decided that since he wasn't going to be paid for all of these arch supports that he was recommending and providing to his patients, that he would go ahead and bill for an AFO. He is now making restitution of almost $380,000. Now that seems to me to be an ethical dilemma for a doctor who can't, because he's not being paid for one item, he will go ahead and bill something completely different and that is a covered benefit. Collusion with providers. Service that is not medically necessary, but the member and the provider work together to document the necessity of this procedure and convince the insurance company to pay for this. Another situation is where the diagnosis is changed from a non-covered problem to a covered benefit in order to get that paid. And these two, quite frankly, are probably the two most common types of fraud. They happen on a regular basis. Think about your own situation, people that you know. Think if maybe that has not occurred in the lives of somebody that you know. And then foreign claims. This is just, foreign claims, quite frankly, are almost a nightmare to try to figure out if they really happened. You have cosmetic surgery clinics. You have cancer clinics. You have arthritis or any other kind of malady that perhaps is terminal, that these facilities in foreign countries will convince you that they can solve and they can help. Recently, they took down a clinic in Mexico that was treating cancer patients with magnets. They had this newfound technique that was just wonderful. And these kinds of clinics prey on the desperately ill. And they charge a lot of money for these dubious kinds of treatments. Healthcare field experts will tell you that these kinds of situations and healthcare in general is a magnet for fraud. They prey on the desperately ill, they charge a lot of money, and they target the most vulnerable of our society. These people are looking for hope, and this is what they get, some charlatan. This particular case that they concluded, the Federal Trade Commission had one of their consumer protection people look at this machine. It was called a Zoetron machine. It was new technology, and it was wonderful. They determined that this particular device, the magnetic field, had basically the same amount of power as that of a regular refrigerator magnet. So it was nothing of value. This here is taken directly from some advertisements for cosmetic surgery and a place to stay outside of the U.S. Hop a flight to Cozumel for a week-long resort stay. Poolside lounging, fine dining. Do all of this great convalescing in paradise as you recover from plastic surgery. Here are some pictures, a couple of hospital rooms. I have never seen a hospital room like that. But if you look closely, those do look like hospital beds. But there's nothing else that looks like a hospital room. Kind of amazing. You know, the health insurance companies really don't care if people go down and have cosmetic surgery at one of these places, have a good time, come back looking great, feeling wonderful about yourself. But what really is the problem is these places will then bill the insurance company for some other procedure that would be covered normally, and don't even tell the companies that it was cosmetic surgery. And so people will hope to get free cosmetic surgery at a wonderful location. There's another huge problem. You may have read about it or seen some things. ABC's Primetime did a big expose on this, on rent-a-patient schemes. One of the situations that was all over Southern California, they would convince people to go down to Southern California to one of these clinics and have a procedure done. Normally it was a colonoscopy. Now, colonoscopy in Utah will cost you from $2,500, $3,000, roughly. These people would go down, have this colonoscopy. They would be given free airfare, nice place to stay while they were there. They'd get cash. They'd even have cosmetic surgery in return for letting them do a colonoscopy on them. And then these insurance billing mills would send bills for $30,000 to $50,000 for procedures. And a lot of insurance companies were paying millions of dollars for these surgeries. Here's an article that was in the Wall Street Journal talking about the raids that the FBI did on several of these clinics down in Southern California. Let me show you the story briefly of one of these rent-a-patients. His name is Julio Hernandez, lived in Arizona. He was convinced by one of his coworkers and some others that he should go down to Southern California and have some surgery done. He could make a lot of money. This would be good. He would really benefit from this. Well, during a five-month period, he would go back and forth to Southern California. He had a circumcision, a removal of his sweat glands, a nose operation, a colonoscopy, and an endoscopy. And he admits freely that he didn't need any of this, but he was making $800 every time he did it. And the insurance companies were billing hundreds of thousands of dollars for these kinds of things. So it's a major problem. Hopefully we're having some impact. The FBI, several of the county prosecutors, different counties in Southern California are working on this case, but it's big time and it exists. Now we have found, as Mark and I go out and do investigations and talk to people and do interviews, that really a face-to-face interview is the most effective. Think about it, it's very easy to lie on the phone when you don't have to look somebody in the eye, you just, oh yeah, and you can lie easily. When it's a face-to-face interview, body language sometimes just shouts out. Little things become very obvious. So we like to do our interviews face-to-face. We like to stay as sharp as we can, keeping up on different techniques and training. And we'd like to show just a little short training video that hopefully will help you as you work with people, talk to people, and help you elicit information from these people.
This is the city. Los Angeles, California. Some people rob for pleasure. Some rob because it's there. You never know. My name's Friday. I'm a cop. I was working the day watch out of robbery when I got a call from the Acme School Bell Company. There'd been a robbery.
There's been a robbery.
Yes, sir. What was it?
My clappers.
Your clappers.
Yeah, you know those things inside the bell that makes them clang?
The clangers.
That's right, we call them clappers in the business.
A clapper caper.
What's that?
Nothing, sir. Now, can I have the facts? What kind of clappers were stolen on this caper?
They were copper clappers.
And where were they kept?
In the closet.
Uh-huh. You have any ideas who might have taken the copper clappers from the closet?
Well, just one. I fired a man. He swore he'd get even.
What was his name?
Claude Cooper.
You think
That's right. I think Claude Cooper copped my copper clappers. Kept in the closet.
You know where this Claude Cooper is from?
Yeah. Cleveland.
That figures. That figures.
What makes it worse, they were clean.
Clean copper clappers.
That's right.
Why do you think Cleveland's Claude Cooper would cop your clean copper clappers kept in your closet?
Only one reason.
What's that?
He's a kleptomaniac.
Who first discovered the copper clappers were copped?
My cleaning woman. Clara Clifford. That figures. Now let me see if I got the facts straight here. Cleaning woman Clara Clifford discovered your clean copper clappers kept in a closet were copped by Claude Cooper, the kleptomaniac from Cleveland. Now, is that about it?
One other thing.
What's that?
If I ever catch kleptomaniac Claude Cooper from Cleveland who copped my clean copper clappers from kept in the closet...
Yes?
I'll clobber him.
You know, unfortunately, these two fine men are gone, but I think this is classic. What we're going to talk about now is dependent eligibility fraud. And we're going to talk about married dependents. And this is how it all started. What happened, a young lady went to a local hospital to have her baby. Well, she checked in under her maiden name. And the people that came to visit her were coming in to look for her married name. And so the nurses were getting really confused because here is this person with two different names and, you know, who are you? Well, one day a nurse went up to her and said, you know, we're really confused here. Who are you? He says, well, I'm Sally Jones, but I go under my maiden name because I can stay on my mom's policy and get my babies paid for free. And, well, is that okay? She says, oh, yeah, I've done that twice already. Well, she picks up the phone and calls our hotline and says, I think there's a problem here. We started investigating it, and what we found going through medical records is, you know, when you tell a lie, how many in here have anyone under the age of 18 in their home? Okay? When they tell a lie, can they come back and tell the same lie exactly the same two or three times later? No. If it's the truth, they can. It's very easy to tell the truth because it's the truth. But if it's a lie, it's hard to do that. Well, what happens, and this is hard to see because of the projection, but they would check in, and on one form, they put down that they're single. And then they forgot that they wrote single, and they said, I'm married. And then another form, on this one, the nurse wrote down here, HUSB at BS, husband at bedside. And so we got all this information, and we went to the mother and the daughter and said, hey, what's going on here? And she said, well, you know, my daughter can't afford insurance. They're newlyweds, and I kept them on my insurance. They said, well, you can't do that. She says, yeah, I know that, but in order to have her have the babies paid for, I kept them on. Well, unfortunately, that's called insurance fraud. Remember we talked about the definition, about the intent? They both had the intent to defraud the insurance company by posing as the still single under the parents' plan. And as a result, felony charges were filed against the mother and the daughter. $10,000 in restitution was sought. The mother, who worked in a hospital, lost her job as a result of this, and their coverage was terminated. Didn't go too far. But we said, you know, if this is the case, is there other people out there? So what we did is we took a database of all dependents between the age of 18 and 26 and sent that to the state and compared all those names to the names of all the people that had been married. And they compared, if you had to do it by hand, it would have taken you forever, but by the computer, they matched it up, and we got a hit of back about 3,500 names of people that were still on their parents' policy, but they were married. So we started interviewing these people, going face-to-face, talking to people, and as a result of this investigation, and it's been going on about 3 years now that we've started this, we have recouped approximately $1 million just from money that had been paid out on these dependents. And we went to the state and said, hey, talk to the other insurance companies. So all the other insurance companies got involved, and throughout the state of Utah, they identified 36,000 dependents that were still on their parents' plans that should have been off. And this ended up into approximately $7 million of charges that should not have been paid. And what was amazing, a lot of these kids could have qualified for Medicaid if they had just done what they were supposed to do. But they decided to keep those people on the policies. Then we thought, well, hey, if married kids are staying on the policies, how about divorced spouses? So we did the same thing. We took all the names, ran it against the divorce names in the state, and bingo, in the state there's approximately 17,000 divorced spouses that shouldn't have been on the other spouse's insurance. And that ended up to millions of dollars in that area. And one thing that what happens in this area is that if the judge says to keep if you're divorced, you have to provide insurance, well, they were saying you got to keep that person on your insurance. Well, you can't keep them on, but you need to provide a policy. So that spouse needs to go buy a new policy or COBRA or something to get covered, but you can't keep them. And we've been doing a massive education with the judges saying, when you give these divorce decrees, will you please don't say keep them on the policy. Just say you need to provide insurance. And that has been a great help. In about the last 2 years, we've seen a significant decrease in the problems from the divorces. Large corporations, this has gone nationwide. Daimler Chrysler found 27,000 of their dependent people that had ineligible members still on their policy. Ford Motor Company found 50,000. So this was a very, very big epidemic starting about 3 years ago. And now I think the insurance industry has a handle on it, and it's coming about because there's a lot of education. There's been a lot of press releases in the newspaper and in the news about this. And when we started this, we would talk to these people face to face, and some of the excuses, just two of them. One of them said, well, my agent said I could keep my son or daughter on our insurance policy once they're married. Now, I know that's not true because all agents know that they can't do that. And another one, and this was the classic one, I called up a mother and I said, you know, your daughter got married last February. She goes, no, she didn't. She got married in August. And this was like in September. And I said, no, the state said February. She says, look, I can show you the photographs of me standing in the wedding line. I paid a whole lot of money for a wedding up at Alta, and I know my daughter got married in August. And I said, well, do me a favor. Go back and talk to your daughter and see why there was a date in February. Well, she called me back about a half hour later, apologized, and said, you know, I'm going to kill my daughter. Her boyfriend worked for an airline, and in order for the two of them to fly around the country free, she had to be his spouse. So they got married and flew around the country on vacations, but they still pretended to be single. So she would live at home, he would live at home, and they'd go out on dates, and that was their married life. And she says, I paid a very expensive wedding, and they were already married, and she was really fit to be tied. But, hopefully we didn't break up too many families in that, but it's amazing at some of the results, and I can go on for hours on that situation. Now, Dwight's going to talk about the divorces.
Personally, I think these are even more interesting. We did the same thing with the state. We matched up married subscribers and members to the state divorce databases, and then we'd come up with a X number of individuals look like they may have been divorced. We'd run them through some other queries and whatnot and come up with a much smaller number of possible divorces. So we would start making phone calls trying to determine if in fact there had been a divorce, and if so, why hadn't they taken their spouse off of their health insurance policy? I can't tell you how many times when I would ask a couple of questions about a divorce and tell them, well, we have information from the state that you were divorced on this date. What do you mean we're divorced? I had no idea we were divorced. And so I would have to go and find out, did you ever file for divorce? Well, yeah, but we decided not to get divorced. Well, it went through, apparently. And so I, more than probably a half a dozen couples, I was the one that told them they were divorced. And they had no idea. Now, I don't even want to get into the ramifications of the IRS and tax returns, joint loans, any of those kinds of things, where they thought they were married, but they really weren't. Here's a funny one. I can't resist telling you this one. There was a gentleman that was living back east, married back there, had an insurance policy with a health insurance company in the east, decided after a while that he wanted to be divorced. So he went to a judge, said, I'd like to divorce my wife. The judge says, that's great, but you can't do it in this jurisdiction. I have no authority here. You're going to have to go over to this location. The guy decided it was either too much trouble, too much money, or he didn't have the time, and he never did it. So then a while later, he moves out to Utah without his wife and without ever getting the divorce. After a time here, he meets somebody, decides he wants to get married, so he does. His second wife. And then two insurance companies started talking, and, well, we understand he may be married. He's married back here. Well, gee, we... So the insurance company from back east gives them a call and says, hey, we're having a little problem here. Can you tell us? It looks like you've got two wives. He says, well, you know, in Utah, you can be married to more than one wife and you can have insurance to cover them both. He actually said that. I'm not sure what the insurance company at the other end thought about that one. But. And then one last interesting one is, we had a guy that ended up in the hospital, and there were some notes in the hospital records that he had said to somebody there when he was admitted that he was divorced. Well, he had also signed in under his wife's insurance policy, so we figured we've got to figure out what's going on here. Is he married? Is he divorced? What's going on? So I talked to his wife, and she says, oh, I can't imagine why he would have said that. We've been married since 2003, and I just can't imagine why he would have said that. I don't know. I can't answer that for you. Okay, well, I appreciate the information. So I talked to him. I said, what's going on? We have information that you may be divorced, but yet you're married. What is your status? He says, oh, I don't know why you think I'm divorced. My marriage date of Valentine's Day, 2004, was the most important date of my life. Why would I say I was divorced? Okay, well, I appreciate it. She says 2003, he says 2004. Did some more checking, went back to him and said, listen, I cannot find a record of this marriage anywhere. County, state, anywhere. Where'd you get married? He said, oh, I forgot to tell you this part of it. We never did get a license. I just had a friend who was a deacon. We went up into the mountains and had a beautiful wedding ceremony. And you know, even though the state doesn't know about it, what's important is it was done in the eyes of God. So we're married. Well, needless to say, we didn't think they were married. The law didn't think they were married. So they weren't married. And he wasn't eligible for any coverage under his wife's policy. Let's talk about some very basic elements of policy fraud. A working definition that you can use on a daily basis and that we use is obtaining a policy of insurance or a specific coverage by use of false, incomplete, or misleading information when the policy would not otherwise be issued and the coverage would not otherwise be afforded. Now, here are some basic elements of application fraud. The applicant provides false, incomplete, or misleading information to the carrier for the purpose of obtaining a benefit not actually entitled to receive. The carrier relies upon the bad information to determine whether to issue a policy or afford coverage. And that policy fraud is contractual fraud, and it voids the contract. Now, dependent eligibility fraud, we'll take this a step further, talking about application fraud, again, the misrepresentation of the following facts will usually be considered material to the issuance of coverage. The family medical history, occupation, lifestyle, identity, health, and eligibility status of dependents. This is an interesting case. This is a picture or copy, and you probably can't see it very well, of a benefit election form. And the top half, this individual was to list his family members, who was going to be covered on this policy. So he lists, first of all, a son, another son, a daughter, and then a spouse. Almost as an afterthought. Now, most of us, and I'm not saying everybody, but most of us would put our spouses first and then our children. So that kind of drew our attention to what was going on. And then down at the bottom, and I know you probably can't see that, this is a beneficiary designation. The primary beneficiary is one of the daughters. The secondary beneficiary is a son. And the wife is not on there anywhere. Now, I don't know about you, but if I didn't include my wife as the primary beneficiary, she'd probably start collecting on it before I was ready. So we went ahead and did a little investigation, tried to find out some information. He'd been divorced from a woman quite a while before, and this was just his girlfriend. Decided he could probably get her on there. Now, if that isn't a lack of ethics and honesty, I don't know what is. Couple of things about misrepresentation. It must be material. In other words, absent the misrepresentation, the policy would not have been issued or the coverage would not have been afforded. A legal definition given to us by the courts is a misrepresentation will be considered material if a reasonable insurance company, in determining its course of action, would attach importance to the fact misrepresented. And, of course, on that, we're all familiar with 2 years of a period of contestability. Beyond 2 years, then it becomes a little dicey as to whether that will have any effect any longer. Now we'll tag team here and we'll give it over to Mark.
On agent and brokers, on you, we came across this and I thought it was pretty interesting, is the vast majority of insurance agents are like a good neighbor and are on your side, and when you're dealing with them, you're in good hands. You know, insurance agents help you to get the best rates and make certain that you're paid when you have a claim. But unfortunately, as in every element, in every profession that's out there, there are the bad apples. There's those that tend to be a little creative and cross the line. And when I was talking about ethics, you can see here, this one was a husband and wife who took payments from over 300 victims and didn't forward that money on to the insurance company. They were sentenced to 2 years in prison in order to pay $183,000 in restitution. A Florida agent misappropriated more than $30,000 in workers' comp insurance premiums, and they used those funds, she used them for her own use. What was interesting in all these cases, it's a premium issue, and they tend to keep those premiums and not forward it on like they should. This case has a lot of red flags in it. This was a Salt Lake insurance agent that sold a business insurance policy to a bar. The bar, he provided a binder, and the guy provided his the premiums to the agent, but the bar burned down. The owner went to the insurance company and said, I have a claim. They go, well, you don't have insurance with us. Well, when it turns out, the agent took the premiums himself. And the key here is he convinced the owner to write the checks out to the agent personally because he said it's more convenient for the bank that way. And he collected $20,000 in insurance premiums, never forwarded on, and unfortunately this person now has a nice bed at the point of the mountain. The remedy, the rescission, voids the policy, and because the insurance contract was based on a fraudulently secured offer and acceptance, we can void that policy. And the carrier, again, must refund all those premiums paid and then the carrier can deny those claims. Another thing is bad apples, talking about bad apples, twisting. That's when an agent would try to get someone to turn in one investment for another, and it's for the benefit of the agent, not for the person. We heard about that in the first thing on ethics. Another one is slamming. In Nevada, they had a problem with people sending out mail that looked like renewal notices or invoices, and people were paying them thinking that this was their insurance. I get that all the time in my mail. You know, I get stuff that looks like it's from the IRS, and I open it, and it's an advertisement or someone trying to get me to do something with their business, but it really isn't. I have it for my mortgage company, and I thought, well, wait a minute, this came from Irvine, California. I know my mortgage company's not there, and it turns out that some company got my information through the legal records and is trying to get me to roll my mortgage over to their company. So this happens all the time. But what's amazing is you, agents and brokers, are the most underutilized partner in combating insurance fraud. We haven't utilized it, and I think this is a great opportunity to develop that relationship with the agents and the SIUs and the different people working in insurance companies, because you are a very, very valuable investigative resource. You are on the front line. You're the first person that's dealing with these people in the application phase, and you can become a great participating in that investigation. Like I mentioned, you had the first contact with the customers. You have personal contact with them, and you have community-based knowledge. You're out in the community. You know what's going on out there, and you have you're familiar with these people. And one thing that is great is that perpetrators must deal with those agents and brokers, and that's why it's so important to develop that relationship back and forth.
Okay, let's talk real quickly here about fraud prevention at the agency and what different roles are here. Did I skip one here? Okay, the producer's role in the fraud mitigation. The producer is on the front line. Every component of the insurance industry is interdependent upon each other to make sure that this whole system works and it's effective and that we eliminate the fraud. The producer is an important component of overall effort. Fraud mitigation is everybody's responsibility. And an SIU is only as effective as each other component allows. In training at the agency level, you can have in-agency presentations, agent association presentations, similar to what we're doing today, face-to-face visits, and utilize claim investigations to illustrate the application of fraud mitigation or prevention according to certain situations. And then the producer as a fraud prevention partner reinforces the ethical behavior at the very inception of the policy, discourages soft fraud, deters hard fraud, gathers intelligence in the questions and answers that come through, and then carries an anti-fraud message or promotion to the very grassroots level. Hard fraud is solid dollars. Soft fraud are those kinds of things that could become hard dollars. Application fraud, for example, may turn out to be hard dollars, may not, but that is fraudulent.
It's like, as a result of this education, people are not going to commit fraud, and so we have stopped that. And as a result of an investigation, someone who might have committed it will not, and so we've stopped. We turned the faucet off and stopped the hard dollars, but as a result of that, it stopped potential problems coming from downstream.
The same questions that discourage perpetrators help producers get to know their customers and better identify and understand their customers' needs. Honest consumers appreciate the efforts to reduce fraud losses. And applicants who object to questions probably have something to hide. When there is a strong effort at fraud prevention at the agency level, perpetrators will tend to go away. The producer is perceived as caring about his customers, and any business discouraged by fraud prevention practices was probably bad business in the first place. Ethics and leadership. Through studies, through surveys, through historical perspectives, subordinates will forgive almost any deficiency in their leaders, except for lack of integrity. Ethical behavior is not confined to a legal code. It's really on a higher plane than codified law. Let me give you one quick example. Lying or betraying the confidence of a friend is not necessarily against the law, but it is very unethical. And we need to try and take ethics to a much higher plane. Now, as we deal with people on a daily basis, our customers, our clients, sometimes we really need to be flexible in working with them. We don't throw our ethics out the window, but we want to be flexible, think outside the box as we deal with these people. We'd like to show you one last quick training video that may help to point out the importance sometimes of being a little flexible in how we work with people.
Enjoy your flight. Thanks. Hello. Oh, I'm sorry. We're only boarding rows 9 and above right now. You'll have to wait.
I'm in row 8.
Please step aside, sir.
It's just one row. Don't you think it's okay if I...
We'll call your row momentarily. Step aside, sir. Thank you for waiting. We'd like to continue boarding the aircraft now. We're now boarding all rows, please. All remaining rows. Hello. Enjoy your flight.
Now, that may be an extreme, but we do. In as we work with customer service, we deal with our clients, our people, we need to be flexible. We need to try to meet their needs. We need to be consumer-oriented. Mark and my contact information, if you ever want to give us a call, you've got a question, you are aware of a problem, particularly if it regards Select Health, feel free to give us a call. We appreciate being here. We hope that it's been beneficial to you. And thank you for your participation and being here. Thanks. I can't get it off.
Oh, I think you have there to do goes. The power. And look at the time.
Yeah, right on.
Right
Bingo.
On.
Oh.